Fingers crossed, recording works this time. All right, welcome to Office Hours with Cloud Posse, your weekly dose of insider DevOps trends, AWS news, and Terraform insights, all sourced from our SuiteOps community, plus a live Q&A that you can't find anywhere else. It's July 31st, 2024. I'm your host, Eric Osterman. Real quick, I'm the founder and CEO of Cloud Posse. We're a DevOps accelerator that focuses on funded startups and enterprises and helps them and their teams who are overwhelmed with AWS. And we do this by leveraging our over 200 Terraform modules that have been battle tested and downloaded over 100 million times. So no matter where you find yourself on this journey, we're here to help your startup launch better products faster so you can free up your time for innovation. And if you're curious about any of that, you can book a call with me directly. Just go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. All right, so how can you maximize today's session? First off, our format is very informal. Engage as much as you'd like, ask questions. And if you're curious about any of our open source tools or modules, go for it. And for any of you on the recording, we host these calls live, so don't miss out. You can join us by going to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Now, I do have one ask. If you find any portion of today's session valuable, share it with your team. Just head over to youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse, and you'll find a recording of this session in a few hours after the call. All right, so let's get started with some announcements. I had quite a lot of interesting things come across my news feed this past week, so let's see how far we get. All right, so I feel like this is deja vu. I thought this happened a long time ago, and the same attack vector. Basically, the method of which systems boot up from the BIOS was vulnerable in systems going back to the dawn of computing, and then that was supposedly fixed by a secure BIOS. And then, the key leaked, and guess what key it was that leaked? It was like the test key, I think. And what I don't understand is why is the test key what's used to, protect the secure BIOS in production. So seems like with every, advancement in security, we're always, two steps back again. So anyone know more about this? Next one. I don't know how this is possible. I'm scratching my head. Oops, wrong link. There we go. You can now run Mac OS inside of a VM in Docker. Well, I guess that's the secret, is that you can run VMs inside of Docker. And then you can therefore deploy or use Docker as a distribution method for Mac OS and then remotely connect to it over KVM. And all that's made turnkey by this Docker container. So pretty cool. Licensing, I'm curious, how does that work? I guess Mac OS is shipped more or less for free, assumes you have Mac hardware. Can anyone explain how that works, how you're able to do Mac OS in a VM without violating licenses? All right.
You probably could get a job if you could. So, yeah.
Well, I guess it's just permitted in some sense if they're able to get that far. At least there's no controls in place. It's not like, leeching Windows where you need to at least get that serial number, at least back in the day. I mean, I'm dating myself in high school, but all right. This was just brought across to my attention. So Truffle Security discovered that you can access any data of a deleted repository associated with a fork. And at first I was like, oh, this is a big to-do about nothing. I was like, yeah, of course. I mean, this is why you can you see the list of fork histories of a repository, and if they had any branches, you can view those. And if there's a pull, the other way is like, if you open a pull request from a branch to the target repository, you want to go and see what that pull request contained. And that was in that other repository, right? So it makes sense that they have this built-in and native into GitHub to be able to reference the metadata of that. Plus, I mean, look, I'm a contributor. I open up a fork and do a small one-line fix to your project. I don't want to keep your repository around forever, but I made that contribution and you want to see the contribution I made, so it has that copy. So I understand why GitHub works that way, and it makes sense. It's just interesting, an interesting side effect of this happening is that, well, yeah, when people create those forks and are kicking around with your project, they might not realize what they're doing, or they might just to test that feature, not, appropriately operationalize and deploy it. So they add a commit where they add a key. That's actually a legit key they committed. But hey, I'm just going to throw away this repository anyways, right? So that's going to be gone. It's not going to be, exposed, right? Wrong. So that's why this actually is a problem. It's that people might inadvertently reveal information in their fork that they might not have meant to do. And I don't know what the right solution is, other than, I guess, what GitHub should do is probably just preserve precisely that commit information that the pull request was based on from the fork, but not preserve any other metadata. And I don't know. Well, you're still probably going to want to see all those previous commits. And if people didn't squash it, we have the same problem. I don't know how you solve this problem in a way that preserves kind of like the integrity of GitHub and open source and what you're working with. Matt, any thoughts on this one or others?
Yeah, don't commit API keys to Git.
Yeah.
Mean, it's as simple as that, right? That it's not a problem. Or if you do, rewrite history.
But the person, probably who did that in the beginning isn't aware of rewriting history to begin with. So,
Oh, I don't know that that's true. I've accidentally committed an API key before, and then I either invalidate the API key or rewrite history so that that doesn't happen again, whichever is easier, so it doesn't get leaked.
You could also use just a pre-commit to check for secrets, and then you never have to worry about it again. So you make the mistake once, you delete your API key, and then you add the pre-commit check, and then you never have to worry about it again.
Also, GitHub secrets detection is pretty good for certain types of key formats. I know somebody recently told me they committed, and like seconds later they had an email from GitHub that they leaked a secret accidentally. So I thought that was pretty
Yeah.
cool.
But your only choice then is to invalidate the key and get a new one.
OpenAI has already been trained on how to use it. Right, next announcement. So Homebrew, there's been other news I forgot to link to about Homebrew. I believe one of the, well, I guess, I'm not sure if it's one of or the creator or founder of Homebrew has decided to go full time or all in on Homebrew. It has to date been more or less a side project, which is pretty remarkable. It's like if the Debian package management system was just part-time by one person. Obviously, Homebrew exists because of the community aspect. So what Homebrew has done incredibly successfully is create the community around Homebrew that supports and maintains Homebrew. Maybe it's related to that, I'm not sure, but they have gone through a security audit now, which revealed a few weaknesses. Apparently nothing super critical, but cause for concern that they remedied. So if you're curious about that audit, it could be good. Why I think this is an interesting audit is they also go into an audit of the CI and CD system through GitHub Actions that they use. And those are, attack vectors that might affect you as well if you have an open source project or are using CI or GitHub Actions rather. Okay, so AutoMQ looks like an interesting project. I forget if we brought this one up or it was another MQ alternative. What I thought was interesting about this one, so anyone who's worked with Kafka over the years knows it's a beast. It was kind of born in an era before how to automate cloud was, obvious. Its reliance traditionally on Zookeeper and its architecture in Java was difficult to run inside of a containerized environment. That's changed. It's come leaps and bounds from 5, 6 years ago when I know we were trying to automate it in Kubernetes, and stupid things like it would remember the IP of the pod, and if the pod came back, or like if you're using persistence and the pod came back, it would still think it was on the old IP. So things like that were cumbersome to overcome. Now there's an operator, for example, for Kubernetes, so it's easier. That said, what if you just rethought about how to implement Kafka? And that seems like what they've managed to do. I'm not sure that it maintains complete feature set of Kafka, and sometimes that the devil is in the details, and that's why things are down the way they are. But they've been able to achieve this using a combination of S3 and EBS to create a more cloud native open source alternative to Kafka for scale. I'm curious, I didn't look to see the corporate backers here, Huawei, Baidu, Tencent. So it looks like possibly this is something that's originated out of China. And China has a really robust open source ecosystem. Their tech companies are producing a lot of cool open source projects to support the incredible scale that they operate their platforms on over there. So, yeah, just thought I'd share that. Anything else? Anyone take a look at AutoMQ before? So the thing that is filling up my LinkedIn news feed is all the news around this. It was kind of, I'm not sure if this, as far as I understand, this is ground zero. This was the post that started it all. Somebody was trying to create a repository with code commit, pretty routine thing, especially if you're doing infrastructure as code, and suddenly it stopped working. I believe it was turned off in any new accounts. And you can request it to be re-enabled, but it would come out later on in announcements. And Jeff Barr acknowledges that Code Commit and Cloud9 and a number of other services have been slated to be sunset. And I think this is going to be around for another year or so. And I don't really know anybody using Code Commit, and that's probably why. And Amazon acquired Cloud9 when browser-based IDEs was all the rage. I think GitHub's Copilot and some others, I'm drawing a blank right now, have one out on that. And honestly, I think all this is just because Amazon needs to conserve more money on AI, so they or that they can direct or funnel to AI. So they finally reached the point where there's, mothballing or sunsetting services at AWS, which is why it's apropos to bring up. So Sumit Rao, he has a lot of cool little GitHub repositories, and he started this project, which is probably one of the only places to track deprecations on AWS. And, full transparency, AWS has been really great about not deprecating services. They have been the opposite of Google when it comes to this. But maybe we've reached the tipping point and there's a change of heart. I know Amazon's been doing some restructuring of their teams and other things like that. Maybe that's involved, or maybe that's also affected development and support of some of these products. So we talked about Snowmobile being deprecated recently, which has been replaced by another more efficient service. I believe Matt was saying something about WorkDocs, their attempt to take over Google Docs, if you will, and Office 365. Yeah, right. OpsWorks, now Code Commit. So the only cool thing about code commit that I could see is two things. Not as a replacement for GitHub, GitLab, etc., but as a Git compatible backup for your version control if you wanted to implement, on our long-term roadmap, it was one of these things. How can we reduce our reliance on GitHub from a disaster recovery perspective? So one of our thoughts was to introduce some way to perform some of the operations through code commit, perhaps. The other use case that I saw for code commit was if you wanted to create your own, Heroku Vercel-like pass where you use Git as the way to affect change, then I thought code commit is a pretty nice way of using Git for that. It could just be another origin that you push to, and then that triggers code builds and code pipelines and so forth. But shy of that, not much reason for it. So, is anyone going to be bit or affected by this code commit change? Have any other opinions on it? Michael, if you raise your hand.
Yeah, I'm not saying I'm going to be bit by this. I think it's really interesting. Because like you said, back in the day when all this stuff was coming out, that it was really cool. You could have your own little IDE in the cloud and everything. But I think to AWS's credit, they're following what their customers want. And I think because more developers are using AWS than are using code commit, they've added GitHub to their services. Not to their services, but I mean as a trigger to their services. So if you look at I forget the name of all the services, but like AWS App Runner, AppSync, the other sort of repository driven services that they host, there's almost always a link to add a GitHub trigger. So they know that people are developing on GitHub. So they're like, hey, why are we running this thing that nobody's using? And so they can get rid of it. Downside for getting rid of it though, I did appreciate how code commit you could use IAM policies to manage the access to the repo, where you can't really do that with other repos. You know, maybe you can, but yeah, that's one feature that I'll miss.
Interesting. Is with Git, I've only thought of, and the only way we predominantly use GitHub OIDC is for AWS, for GitHub access to AWS resources. Is there something similar to that for AWS access to GitHub resources where you could get a temporary GitHub token for a little
Yeah,
bit?
there is. You can,
OIDC.
yeah, I'm forgetting the name of the service right off the top of my head. It might be code pipeline or code build or something like that, where you say, you set up, it's like a separate configuration, but you set up a repository configuration, you log in, set the permissions and everything, and then code build or code pipeline or whichever one it is will follow CodeStar.
CodeStar makes them all
Thank
go
you.
together.
Yeah,
You're welcome.
all of those. Yeah, they'll follow the repo that way.
Well, to be clear, okay, so that makes sense. But to be clear, I was looking more like how can you get the same if, like you have the short-lived STS tokens that you get in AWS using GitHub OADC in the in that direction. Matt, are you saying you can do something like that in the other direction to get a token to GitHub resources that's usable in AWS? No, okay.
I was just saying, like ODIC, ODIC in the opposite direction. I was like mid-sentence, basically, like OIDC. Yes, I said it like backwards twice, but then my point was that if somehow GitHub trusted a third party to issue GitHub tokens, then that would work.
Yeah.
It would be interesting.
Yeah. That
I
would be
mean,
interesting.
technically it's OAuth, right? Like GitHub authentication is OAuth, so you should be able to do that, but you'd have to figure it all out, like exactly what you're trying to do.
Interesting. All right, so that was that topic. Anyone have something to add to this, the deprecations? Oh, okay, so just other
Google
things.
just got rid of their repos though too, didn't they? Didn't GCP just, yeah. So I don't think that AWS is the first, so maybe they're just following suit.
Yeah, maybe. Well, Google shuts down almost everything they launch that isn't search.
Well, no, not until they have three different things that do the same thing with three different names. Then they shut down the one that works the best, is how it generally works. But yeah, it could just be the market shift. Everyone could just be, tea leaves. Like, we're not going to compete against GitHub and GitLab. Let's just move on.
Yeah. What was Google's service called?
Names aren't my thing, Eric.
I think it was called Cloud Commit. Cloud Commit.
That sounds appropriate.
Right. Got it.
That the same as Google Source, which is their public repos, that hasn't gone away. That's still around. GoogleSource.com.
Right. This is for the private and enterprise repos, I think, is what they retire or announced retirement of.
All right. Okay, next announcement. So I thought this was kind of cool. I stumbled across it entirely by accident. I just wanted to see how to use the GitHub Discussions API, and then I found this. So for a long time, there was a, and there still is, an alternative called Utterances, which has been for GitHub Issues because GitHub Issues have been around forever. And what it is a way that you can host like a static site, but have a persistent backend for comments or discussions. And Utterances did that with GitHub Issues, but that's kind of like an abuse of issues. For a long time, issues were used for discussions as well, but now there are actual GitHub discussions. So this seems like a pretty popular implementation. 7,800 people found it before I did. And uses GitHub Discussions as the backend for that. And that's kind of cool because now you can participate on GitHub naturally how you are participating in discussions on GitHub, and you can also participate on discussions through pages, for example, of your technical documentation. And it's something you can self-host easily on Vercel, and they also provide their own a hosted version that you can use for free as well, I believe. Where was a screenshot or a demo? Yeah, so this is a static page, and I believe this page itself has the embedded discussions here down below. With a GitHub feel to it. And you can see all of the discussions here on that page. So it's kind of cool. Supports emojis and reactions and embeds and all the stuff that you support with GitHub discussions. Anyone have opinions on this? I know we tried Utterances, and in the end, I thought it just got noisy with the issues it created and things. On an unrelated note, I noticed they have translated their README into all of these different languages, and the format looks like by the language code, which made me wonder, does GitHub automatically support localization with READMEs if you provide it in multiple in this format, or is this, somebody has to discover it?
Change your language setting on your browser and see.
Yeah, I don't know where I would do that fast enough to make it practical. All right, thanks for that. All right, GitHub. Oh, sorry, not GitHub.
It's
OpenTofu. What was that
sorry,
meant?
I just if you go to that. I
Oh,
don't
are
want to derail us, but that will
yeah.
actually let you set your language like in like real time. Anyone who's using Arc.
Oh, okay, interesting. Let's see here. So what was one here? Spanish. So if I go to Arc settings, language.
Have to add a language first, and then you can like.
Espanol. And
Move to the top. Yeah.
All right. And then if I go over here to, where was this one? Giskus. And refresh. Did not seem to load it automatically. Maybe it uses other like GitHub profile.
Yeah, maybe.
Also, maybe it's not refreshed. The README is also available in. So
Yeah,
yeah.
which makes me think that they
Yeah.
expect you to just go like click on that thing.
Yeah.
You don't want to leave Spanish at the top.
Mi español muy. I can't even fake it, man. No habla español. There we go. Okay. Yes. OpenTofu 1.8. Velocity picking up from OpenTofu, which is nice as the team is getting more familiar with the code base and making big honking changes. So this is really exciting. Features that have been wanted forever, such as variables in your backend configuration and provider configuration. And variables in your module sources is now supported in 1.8. Plus, because that is a very significant breaking change with the BSL licensed Terraform, they've also introduced the .tofu extension, where if you want code that will only work in tofu, you can put it there. That way, you can, for example, leverage these new features in a version of your code optimized for OpenTofu. For example, let's say you're writing a Terraform child module that's publicly hosted on the Terraform registry, and you want that child module calls other child modules. Now, historically, it's been a pain. If one of those child modules has a bug fix and you really want to incorporate that, you either need to fork the parent child module and make that change, get that upstreamed, or use your fork, or wait for somebody else, to update the child module. With this, you could create a .tofu file, define the module with a dynamic source. So that and optionally a dynamic version, and then if you're calling that module via OpenTofu, now the child modules are configurable from their source and their versions. There are other really interesting things here if you think about it. Like another problem with using open source modules in maybe a regulated environment where you can't depend on external sources or air-gapped versions. So it's kind of tricky. So, it's very easy to vendor in child modules and call those. But what if your child modules themselves call other child modules? Well, with this, with dynamic sources in Terraform, it's cool because you could create a fully static copy of that module and all of that module's dependencies at whatever version you want, and then using variables, provided the modules were updated to support variables, you could now say, hey, use the upstream, or hey, use this local version on my file system, or hey, use it from my private registry. All of that is now possible because of dynamic sources in OpenTofu. Anyone correct me if I'm wrong? I have not tested this. This is me being on my armchair again, but this is why we've wanted it for a long time.
I've been talking to my team about switching to OpenTofu. The biggest blocker people think is silly, but the fact is if I take an enterprise business and with enterprise customers, if I go to them and say I want to use OpenTofu, they will say, "Who named that thing?" So,
Right.
I still think that the naming OpenTofu was a failing, because I actually have had been asked that by like compliance and legal and things like that when I bring these projects up. So.
That's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I have heard that, and I think open source projects as a whole, suffer from naming. That project I was just showing you, GisGus, with 7,800 stars, not the best name. But I like, overall, I like the name OpenTofu. I think there's some kind of funny coincidences with the name that make it work, but I get where you're coming from. Matt, you look like you were
Yeah,
on the cusp of saying something.
I was just going to say I was reading a thing about so Stripe just acquired a company that does that basically is going to allow you to do regulatory compliance or tax compliance basically around the world. Like there are a lot of EU jurisdictions that say if you do business with any citizens of that country, you actually have to have an entity present in that country in order to transact so that they can tax that entity and do all these things. So apparently lots of people are violating world tax laws right now in the way they're operating business. So Stripe acquired this company that helps you set up all those entities and becomes like the entity of record and takes the tax payment or takes the revenue and does the tax payments for you and all of those kind of things. And the name of that company is Lemon Squeezy. So it's like on like easy peasy lemon squeezy, like that whole thing. It's like a take on that. And I was like, for such a serious company, like the name of the company was Lemon Squeezy. Every time I ever saw them, I was like, how does anyone take this company seriously?
Lemon
So
squeeze.
yeah,
I
but it's a
respect
great
that
acquisition
squeezy
for
tens of
Stripe.
thousands of dollars a year, right?
Yeah. I think the way it works is somehow they make it work where they take 5% of your like transaction total, and then somehow they make it all work with that. So I don't know how it works, but it's an interesting business, but it's just along the same topics of the weird naming convention.
So, quick question for Sean, who mentioned the OpenTofu name and legal not liking it. Has that been, is it because of the name you can't use it, or is there other reasons that you can't use it? Or can you use it? I'm just generally curious on how other organizations are, I guess, that don't like the name. Are they using the product, or are they avoiding the product because of the name?
Did we lose Sean? Is he? I don't see Sean in the list
He
anymore. I
dropped.
think Sean dropped off. Yeah.
Yeah, never mind.
He hated the name that much. He just dropped. Very
Very anti-OpenTofu, just joking.
Yeah. All right. Well, so that was that. Let's see what other announcement I think that was related to that. So this was also interesting, and I'm sure this is going to make a lot of people really happy, and I'm going to say for the wrong reasons. So one of the biggest challenges that companies adopting Terraform have when trying to create your Terralith is Terraform doesn't let you iterate easily open lots over a lot of providers. And you can think about all the reasons why this is convenient. Let's say we want to deploy our app in 12 regions throughout AWS. So we're going to provision our PCs there, our clusters there, our apps there, and we're going to just stick all of that in. Well, we neatly create little child modules maybe for our network and for our app and for our clusters, but then we tie it all together in this Terraform root module. And then we create a config file maybe in YAML or in even TFR's file, and in there I can declaratively say all the regions I want to be in, the CIDR block for that region, and it feels very nice. In this one compact module, we've been able to deploy our entire app across all these regions if only Terraform supported for loops around providers, because you need a provider for every region you're going to be in. And that's when the reality sets in, you can't do that. So many have regressed to doing templating of Terraform files or HCL files to get around that. And if OpenTofu could support that natively, now you don't need those hacks and workarounds. And it's very convenient to dynamically create a list of providers in any number of regions or any number of times, depending on what you're trying to do. Except you shouldn't do any of that, because usually the reason why you're trying to do this is maybe for DR, you're going to be in multiple regions. So you might not want to have your state in the one state file that it would all be in, so you get that DR set up. Or what we just heard from one of our customers, they had over 200 providers instantiated, and Terraform took 25 gigs of RAM to build the infrastructure. And that's why you don't do provider for each. And that's why this feature isn't needed. And that's why this is one of those things where it is there for a good reason that you can't do it, because it incentivizes you to do the wrong things. And I say this, sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's a good place to stop, though. I was going to go in a different
Okay.
trajectory if
Well,
that's
then I
compatible
have a
now.
comment.
All
Yeah,
right.
so my comment is, we're letting HashiCorp slash Terraform slash whatever off the hook. I mean, like a for loop, it like operating properly is a core like computer science paradigm that we should support. It's just that their implementation of how they support looping over these things does stupid things like end up taking 25 gigs of RAM and and storing a giant state like all in one state and all those kind of things with no alternative and no proper way to do that. Like this is like putting a band-aid on the gunshot wound, kind of thing. Like we need to fix the core of what the problem is, because that paradigm should be supported.
Okay, no, that's a fair point. I was not thinking about it that way. So let me restate what you said, but maybe in a slightly different way. So Matt, I think, brings up the point that the fact that the language can't do this, and it probably should, and it's really exposing a problem of the language and the parts that shouldn't be supported. Well, maybe those are other things the language should just fix as well, or the tool. So the fact that all the state has to be in one file in a single execution or invocation or things like that, maybe that is the fun one of the many fundamental faults that need to be addressed as well. For example, being able to store the state closer to where that provider might be being used. Now, that's not a universal solution. Like, that like in the case of AWS, yeah, we happen to store our state on AWS. But if you're using Datadog, you're not going to store your state on Datadog. You're going to store that in some other storage system. The other problems about, yeah, exactly, using that much memory, that's a consequence of how it's been implemented as a language, and that probably shouldn't be the case to begin with either, doing a for loop. It's not. Plenty of languages have for loops that can iterate over structures larger and more complicated than Terraform and don't use 25 gigs of RAM. So it's, yeah. So I get your point, and those are fundamental issues with them.
Yeah, I was just saying, like, we're kind of mocking, like, that's a bad idea, but it's really it's a bad idea given the state of Terraform today. I agree, but we shouldn't like just let Terraform off the hook to say like we need to fix the core services to fix those things so we can support it. Like
Yeah.
if somehow each individual resource or something had its own state or whatever that would get persisted, then it would be a lot less dangerous to do the kind of things that we're doing, right? Like,
That
because you could
requires
only
50
break.
gigs of RAM because we duplicated it. No, I'm just
Yeah. So anyway, but I don't know. I have lots of thoughts about it, but yeah, I agree that until they fix some other things, not a great idea to just iterate over as many providers as you feel like. But I feel like someone should fix that problem at the core.
sense. All right. Something to add to this? I think, Michael, you had your hand up earlier. I don't remember if you took it down or not. All right. Anyway, so the reason why I brought that up was just that OpenTofu is planning on that in, I guess, an upcoming release. And that's going to create a more significant, larger gap between BSL licensed Terraform and OpenTofu. And those are the kinds of differentiators that OpenTofu needs to make in order to compel a larger group to move over, because they're actually addressing a lot of the problems people have been asking to be addressed for a long time. All right, another one here. GitHub, one of we love and use GitHub Actions extensively. One of the things that's been lacking, and honestly, I think it's still lacking even with this announcement, but at least it's one step in that direction. To me, they did this to check the box. Yeah, we have a dashboard for metrics, but that's about it. So most other build systems, Jenkins, Circle, I assume GitLab, I don't know GitLab, have probably dashboards that are better than this in terms of summarizing, build failures, utilization, most active repositories, and all of that. I'm not sure all the ways you can slice and dice this, but this view that they share is pretty basic. I'm just really curious about the company using this many build minutes per month. That is a large organization. I wonder if this is, inside GitHub or one of their enterprise customers, or just mock data. Who knows? Test Oracle coverage map. Yeah. So, anyways, with this, you get some data about how many minutes you're using, and that gives you the opportunity to optimize maybe workflows that are taking too long, and there can be low-hanging fruit for you to optimize those workflows. And last one, I was debating whether to bring it up or not because I didn't get to study it too deeply, other than it caught my attention because I was all, yeah, isn't that true? Isn't that what it was? So this was trending on Hacker News this week, was the mythology actually around how early origins of the internet, and that it wasn't built originally to withstand a nuclear attack, and that there are some perpetuated myths based on cross-references between different articles, going back all the way to the 90s, information that was also themselves incorrectly quoting other sources. And of course, the internet goes back even 2 decades, or was it 3 decades before that? So, I thought it was interesting because I definitely would have said that it was built to withstand it. Maybe more so now, but not originally. It was not built to withstand CrowdStrike, though. As we saw, the whole internet went down because of one company. All right. Anyone
I
have.
saw, oh, I was just going to say, I saw someone redid that XKCD comic with like the whole thing with the whole internet relies on one open source project that some guy maintains. They redid it with CrowdStrike, basically. It was pretty funny.
That's great. I gotta say that. Yeah, there we
Yeah,
go.
there it is.
Well, too good.
Yeah, I don't know. I did another round of reading and listening to their responses, and the more I heard, the more I was like, oh man, like they don't even have, junior system engineer level, like, checks and balances of what, how they could solve like all these problems. Like, when you realize what actually happened, like, how does their CI/CD process not catch like invalid values being pushed out? And how do they not do some sort of distributed rolling deployments? And, there's a million of them. I know we talked about it last week, but since then I did another deep dive and just kind of went over, like, I jotted down like 25 things that I think they did wrong, and basically just like chatting through the or reading through the descriptions of what happened. So I feel like I should write a blog on it, or maybe I do
Yeah,
one already,
listen,
but
the
it's just
25
so
have
annoying.
to when you're a security startup,
Yeah.
or they're not a startup anymore, really, but
Well, they're not a startup. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
they're doing $3.5 billion in revenue.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the thing, right? $3.5 billion in revenue, and a single engineer can push a single invalid content file to a system that Microsoft has allowed to bypass their kernel driver check at 10 p.m. on a Friday night, and then go home and take down the entire internet. It's like so many checks and balances were missed here. It's just amazing how bad the process is all the way around. So anyway.
Question: if it was you who pushed that update, would you own it and put it on your resume? I took down the internet.
Probably, but I would
After I
spin
got the
it
job, probably. I don't know if I put it on the resume, but like day one, I'd
in.
be like, guess what I've done? Like, you don't want to
Yeah.
like taint the water before you take a swim, but like, I would use that for sure.
It's like you become like that guy who leaned over at the Cubs game, leaned over into fair play and caught the ball that would have like basically had the Cubs win the World Series, and he like make it so it didn't happen. So he's like hated in Chicago. So he'll be like that guy, on a global scale.
All
Oh,
right. Well,
well.
that brings us to the end of my announcements. Anyone have some questions we can get answered today or topics we could discuss? Matt, haven't seen you around. Did you join? Do you have anything on your mind?
No, not really. Yeah, I need to join more often, like I think I typically say, but no, nothing crazy at the moment.
Well, that's good.
I feel like the discussion around should the dynamic providers be implemented is a good one. I feel like I want to share that once the YouTube video comes out with the OpenTofu team.
Yeah.
Because it's a good point. I think that a lot of what's happening with tofu is that there's reasons why Terraform has been hesitant to implement some things. It's like giving users a foot gun. But there's also, there are valid use cases for looping over providers, right? Like you cannot have it be an awful thing for you. It
Yeah.
just, it's you don't want to be too protective. And there's pros and cons to everything. So we'll see how it goes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think my biggest fear with that one is until you've been around the block for a while, you don't really realize a couple of things. And the biggest one with looping over providers is people will generally use looping over providers to act on multiple regions in a cloud at the same time. And then what you don't realize is the reason you're running in multiple regions is for disaster recovery purposes or for business continuity purposes, which means that if one of those regions happens to be down and you need to make a change, your Terraform module can no longer work because it's looping over a particular provider that doesn't exist because a particular region is down. And now you've put yourself into a case where you can't operate on your perfectly valid functioning regions because you've coupled the changes to a region that isn't working anymore. And now you're just like out of luck. And so you either modify your code, or you wait until that region comes back online, which is just seems like a really bad idea to me.
That's a really good point. Which is different than what I was saying. Because I was saying, well, what if your state is in that region that was down? But you're bringing it doesn't even have to be that. Just if one of
Yeah.
those regions that you're going over is down, that whole monolithic component or a root module you're trying to provision is now affected. So
Breaks.
great,
Yeah.
commented that out in my code. Okay, rerun it. Wait, now it wants to destroy that stuff in that region. I still can't run my code even though I removed it from there. So now we got to manipulate and edit the state. So it's just bad news all around in the current way that Terraform works, to your point, Matt. Like,
yeah.
It doesn't have to be that way, but that is how Terraform works.
I agree. That's really concerning. And I think it all, I think this problem of like the way state is dealt with, where we have to break things up into root modules so that we have small blast radius and we can work things with smaller groups of resources. I think that's like the, when it comes down to it, like all the hard problems within infrastructure as code really kind of come back to that. And I feel like the infrastructure as code tool of the future, I hope, like solves that whole thing better. I don't know how it can be done really, really well, but I hope somebody smart is thinking about that.
So
I've given that problem a lot of thought, and the best thing I can come up with for modern clouds, you know, that support, you know, modern clouds, I'll say, is that you have to store the state like on the resource itself, like somehow, like with a tag or, you know, something like that. Clearly that paradigm breaks with, you know, with something that doesn't have that ability, like doesn't have tagging or is, you know, a GitHub repository or something that doesn't have tags or, you know, whatever, something that doesn't support that whole thing. But being able to along with the resource that you're provisioning, like also store some data about how it was provisioned with that, I think would actually solve this problem. But as long as we have an external store that we have to reconcile to what has actually been provisioned, we always run the risk of these kind of problems. And, you know, every tool that uses that paradigm has that as a core limitation and a core problem that you can get into where your state is out of sync with reality, and that always becomes a problem. So yeah, it's not an easy problem by any means.
I almost, how would storing the state of the resource more natively on the resource itself really help? Because it's not as if you wouldn't need to still diff. You still would need to send the GET request to get that information about that resource and then diff it against your desired. Why?
Well,
what is your thought process? Do you mind speaking to it a little bit further than you did?
Yeah. Because right now you have a three-way sync, right? I have code that says my infrastructure should be in state A. I have state that says infrastructure is in state B, and I have the actual infrastructure that says the infrastructure is in state C. And we're doing this three-way dance of trying to reconcile all of those, where if you just had I have code that says I desire state A, and I have infrastructure that is state C, I can just do a two-way diff to figure out like what it is that I want, right?
Okay. So you're saying the cloud provider or the API provider would basically keep their state up to date in their own store, and you would only have to like really request once to say, hey, what do I have provisioned as part of this project or as part of all of my infrastructure? Not necessarily it would be stored on one particular resource, but just more that they're creating
each resource.
Yeah.
So like the provider gives the resource like a unique ID, and then basically you could provide your own unique ID that would get stored along with that. And basically those are the two things that you need to identify, like, this thing was created as the result of my code with, you know, this, you know, unique resource. Because at the end of the day, that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to say, like, how did, like, when I said create an EC2 instance, this EC2 instance with my unique identifier 1234 was created, you know, it, as a result of my code that said create, you know, create an EC2 instance, right? I mean, that's basically what Terraform state is, right? It creates its own unique identifier, which is basically the you know, the resource identifier that you see, like the address in state. And then it's basically taking the state of all of the properties of that thing, and then it's diffing all of those, you know, looking at what your code says it should be and what the cloud is actually, and it's kind of doing that three-way merge to figure out what changes need to be made. And my whole point was is that if you had a way to store the Terraform resource address, if you were will, like on the resource itself, then you could just eliminate state because you could say, give me this resource now. Does it exist? And if it doesn't exist, then you know you need to create it. If it does exist, then you just say, give me all the properties, and you diff the properties, and then you update the properties of what you need to change. And you don't need to write that state anywhere. You just need to always compare to what you get back from the API call. That's kind of my I've whiteboarded this a million times just thinking it through, and that's just the only thing that I ever came up with. But that means that all of the cloud providers and, you know, any other things that you might want to provision have to support that paradigm, which is no easy feat, you know, in and of itself.
Yeah, and I think I get what you're saying now, but you're basically saying that the unique ID would be provided by the desired state, and
There's two unique IDs basically. There's basically like, you know, my unique ID as the creator and the cloud's internal unique ID that they how they track it however they want. And we just basically need to be able to provide one, you know, when we create a resource, and then we can track it back to everything else. So it's interesting, but I don't know how we'd ever get there, but it's just a thought.
Yeah, there would need to be. I don't think it would be possible. Like, no, like you getting API provider support for that type of thing would be such a drastic thing to ask of any API. It'd be very restrictive in terms of the way, maybe not very
Yeah.
restrictive, but it would require a lot. But I could see a middleman actually being that they're consistently gathering the state on a continual basis to keep that up to date. And then there still is the desired state and actual state. And then the middleman is the thing that actually does the updates to the resources
Yeah.
downstream, which should be
Sort of.
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's an interesting one, but although my point that I made before, you kind of missed the subtlety, is that this almost exists in like the major clouds today, because like that's what tags are. Tags essentially are arbitrary data that you want to put on a resource so that you can then look up a resource by a key that you provide.
Yeah, it's just
And
not ergonomic, I
you
guess. I get what you're saying.
know, yeah. And basically, like if they provided a And it's not supported by every resource either, right? But if they provided that and they provided a get by tag for every resource, then you could potentially do this. So I don't,
Yeah,
anyway, that's it.
I didn't get the complete argument onto this last point you said. Now I get it. Yeah.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
get it too. Anyway, good discussion. thanks for going down the rabbit hole with me.
Yeah. And we are at time, but the only thing I wanted to add to this was this is like, if this problem should be solved at all. No, my point here is like, this is not a problem unique to infrastructure. This is a similar problem that exists in very large code monoliths. And when the code monolith gets so large, it's difficult for multiple teams to work on it, to run it, to test it. Any change could disrupt the entire monolith, depending on how it's been deployed. So a movement happened to create service-oriented architectures to break that monolith into smaller pieces that change independently. And that argument goes for infrastructure as well. What we're saying here is if we really, 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 really had to get this massive state in Terraform to be performant, these are some things that we should do. And I'd argue the things that Matt said, those should happen anyways, in terms of being able to claim kind of a resource with some ID, a la tagging or similar. That'd be cool. But in the end, this is why we still probably should think about breaking the infrastructure into smaller pieces, because I don't know about you, if one Terraform plan and apply cycle risks destroying the app in 17 regions, I don't want to touch it. So, all right, that's it. We'll be posting a recording of this session to our YouTube channel. Recording worked this week, I think. So, pretty happy about that. That is youtube.com/cloudposse. Again, youtube.com/cloudposse. If you're interested in talking to Cloud Posse about how we can help you at your business leverage Terraform effectively, go to cloudposse.com/meet. Again, cloudposse.com/meet. And you'll book a session with me directly. Just answer a few quick questions and you'll get a booking form where you can schedule time. Here are some other next actions if you are interested in getting more involved with our community. We have a weekly newsletter at newsletter.cloudposse.com. That is a syndication of some of these interesting news and announcements every week delivered directly into your inbox. We have a podcast, which is This Office Hours in audio format, available however you listen to podcasts. Go to podcast.cloudposse.com to find out more information on that. And if you haven't yet registered for the weekly office hours, like the one we have here today, you go to cloudposse.com/office hours. Again, cloudposse.com/office hours. Yeah, register. You'll get an invite to your email with the details on how to connect. These calls are held via Zoom, and we'll see you here next week, same time, same place. Have a great rest of your week, everyone. Take care. Bye.